A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how people managed before refrigeration. What was daily life actually like? How did people cook? How did they keep food from spoiling? And honestly, most of us open the fridge door without thinking about it. 150 years ago, that box in your kitchen would have been the most miraculous object on Earth.
It really would have. And here's the thing most people don't appreciate. The icebox itself, the mechanical refrigerator's immediate predecessor, was already a revolution when it showed up. But before that, for thousands of years, people ran what was essentially a continuous food preservation operation that never stopped. Every day involved decisions about what to eat now versus what to preserve for later.
The preservation treadmill. That's what I find interesting. You couldn't just stockpile and forget.
And the scale of the pre-refrigeration food system was enormous. In 1870, New York City consumed about 1 million tons of ice per year, harvested from lakes and rivers, mostly in New England, shipped by rail and by boat. The ice trade was one of the largest industries in America before mechanical refrigeration killed it.
1 million tons of ice, moved by human labor. That's the kind of number that makes you realize how much effort we've made invisible.
That was just ice. The ice trade started in earnest around 1806 when a guy named Frederick Tudor, they called him the Ice King, started shipping New England ice to the Caribbean. Everyone thought he was insane. He went bankrupt multiple times. But by the 1830s, he was shipping ice to Calcutta. Ice from Massachusetts arriving in India after 4 months at sea, with only about a third lost to melting.
The Ice King of Massachusetts. There's a title. So before Tudor, before the ice trade, what did people actually do? Because ice was a luxury for most of human history. The wealthy had ice houses, sure. But the average person in, say, 1700s Europe, they weren't chilling their drinks.
They weren't, and that's the key thing to understand. Refrigeration as cold storage is just one preservation method. Before it dominated, people used a whole arsenal of techniques. Salting, smoking, drying, fermenting, pickling, potting, confiting. Each one created a different kind of food, and the rhythm of daily life was built around which technique you were using at which time of year.
Walk me through that rhythm. Say I'm a reasonably comfortable household in England in the 1750s. What does my food year look like?
The year starts with slaughter, typically November. You've been fattening pigs all summer and fall. The weather's cold enough now that meat won't spoil immediately. That's crucial. November is when you kill the animals you're going to eat for the next 12 months.
Because feeding them through winter costs more than the meat is worth.
You keep breeding stock and maybe a milk cow, but everything else gets slaughtered in a narrow window. This is why medieval and early modern Europe had these enormous autumn meat festivals. Martinmas, November 11th, was the traditional slaughter date in much of Europe. You'd have fresh meat for a few days, and then the preservation work begins. Every part of the animal gets used. Blood for blood pudding. Organs eaten immediately, fat rendered, meat salted or smoked, bones boiled for stock.
This is happening in every household simultaneously, which is why the feast then famine cycle was so pronounced. November is abundance. Late winter is deprivation.
The salting itself. Let me give you some specifics because it's more involved than people realize. To salt meat for long-term storage, you pack it in dry salt or submerge it in brine. The salt draws moisture out through osmosis, creating an environment where bacteria can't grow. But it also fundamentally changes the meat. Salted pork is tougher, saltier, and you have to soak it or boil it in multiple changes of water before you can cook with it.
Which means pre-refrigeration cooking was built around ingredients that had already been transformed. You're not reaching for fresh chicken breast. You're reaching for something that's been in salt for 3 months.
This shaped entire cuisines. Think about why so many traditional European dishes are stews and long-cooked braises. It's because you're working with preserved ingredients that need long, slow cooking to become palatable. Salt cod needs to be soaked for 24 hours, then simmered. Dried beans and peas, enormous staples, need hours of cooking. Smoked meats need to be rehydrated.
The cassoulet, as a technological necessity. The French just made it taste good.
And let's talk about the hearth, because this is the other part of the question. How did people cook? For most of human history, cooking meant an open fire. The hearth wasn't just a stove, it was the center of the house. It provided heat, light, and a cooking surface all at once. And managing a hearth fire was a skill that took years to learn.
I've always been curious about the practicalities. How do you control temperature with an open fire?
You don't, really. Not in the way we think of it. You control distance. You move pots closer to or farther from the flames. You build the fire up or let it die down. You use different types of wood for different heat levels. A hearth cook would have multiple fires going at different intensities or different zones in one fire. The hottest part directly over the flames for boiling, a slightly cooler spot for simmering, and the edge of the hearth for keeping things warm.
Multiple burners, just distributed across a stone floor.
There's a piece of equipment that was absolutely central to this, the trammel. It's an adjustable hook hanging from a crane or bar in the chimney. You could raise or lower pots to control how much heat they got. That was your temperature dial. A pot hanging low over the flames is high heat. A pot raised up is your simmer.
The trammel as the original kitchen gadget.
Then there's the bake oven, often separate from the hearth or built into the chimney. These were brick or stone ovens that you'd heat by building a fire directly inside them. Once the oven was hot enough, you'd rake out the coals, swab the floor with a wet cloth to create steam, and put your bread in. The retained heat in the masonry did the baking. You had to judge the temperature by how long flour sprinkled on the floor took to brown, or by how long you could hold your arm inside.
Baking was a whole day event. You're not just popping a loaf in while you do other things.
It was usually a weekly event. Bread was baked once a week, sometimes less often in winter. And that's another preservation question. How do you keep bread edible for a week without a freezer? You make dense, low-hydration breads that dry out slowly rather than molding. Rye breads, the staple in much of northern Europe, could last a week or more. Stale bread wasn't waste. It was an ingredient. You grate it for breadcrumbs. Use it to thicken soups. Make bread puddings.
The entire cuisine is built on the assumption that nothing can be truly fresh for long. Everything has a second life as a different ingredient.
Let's talk about dairy, because this is where things get really interesting. Without refrigeration, milk spoils in hours, so you don't keep fresh milk. You transform it immediately. Butter, cheese, yogurt, clotted cream. These are all preservation methods. Cheese is literally a technology for storing milk calories for months or years.
The harder the cheese, the longer the shelf life. That's not an accident.
Not at all. A hard cheese like Parmesan, developed in the Middle Ages, can last for years without refrigeration. It was designed to be a trade good. And butter, salted butter, keeps for months. Unsalted butter spoils in days. The salt isn't just for flavor, it's functional.
What about vegetables and fruits? You can't salt a cabbage and have it still be a cabbage.
You can, actually. That's sauerkraut. Fermentation is the primary vegetable preservation method across most of the world. Cabbage becomes sauerkraut. Cucumbers become pickles. Grapes become wine, which is also preservation. Grape juice spoils in days. Wine lasts for years. Apples become cider, then vinegar. Milk becomes yogurt and cheese. Every traditional food culture has a fermentation tradition because it was literally the only way to keep most plant foods through the winter.
The pre-refrigeration world was basically one giant continuous fermentation project.
This is the other big one. You can store root vegetables, potatoes, carrots, turnips, parsnips, beets, for months if you keep them cool, dark, and slightly humid. A good root cellar stays around 32 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit year-round, just from being underground. Apples and pears can be stored too, though they need to be wrapped individually to prevent one rotting fruit from spoiling the rest.
The root cellar is the closest thing to a refrigerator that most people had. A hole in the ground that stays at fridge temperature because physics.
It's remarkably effective. There are root cellars in New England that have been in continuous use since the 1700s. The principle is simple. Dig below the frost line, insulate with earth, provide ventilation. But the execution took real knowledge. You had to know which vegetables could be stored together, because some, apples especially, release ethylene gas that makes other things sprout or spoil.
Apples are the refrigerator villains of the root cellar world.
They really are. And this brings us to something underappreciated about pre-refrigeration life, the sheer amount of knowledge every household had to possess. You needed to know how to butcher an animal, how to salt different cuts for different durations, how to manage a root cellar, how to maintain a sourdough starter, how to brew and preserve beer, how to make cheese, how to judge whether preserved food was still safe to eat.
The average person knew more about food preservation than most professional chefs know today, because their survival depended on it.
There's a seasonal rhythm to all of this worth mapping out. Spring was the hungry season, stored food running low, new crops not yet in. People ate a lot of dried legumes and whatever they'd managed to preserve. Summer was fresh eating, vegetables, young animals, eggs, but also when you started preserving for winter. Fruits got dried or made into jams, herbs got hung to dry, vegetables got pickled as they came into season. Fall was slaughter and the big preservation push. Winter was living off what you'd stored.
The hungry spring. That's something we've completely lost. We expect strawberries in February.
We get them, flown in from the other hemisphere. But in the pre-refrigeration world, eating was intensely local and intensely seasonal. You ate asparagus for about 3 weeks in spring, and then you didn't see it again for a year. Strawberries were a June food, and you ate yourself sick on them because you knew they'd be gone in a fortnight.
There's something almost ceremonial about that. The brief window where a food appears, you feast on it, and then it's gone. It makes eating a kind of calendar.
It does, and there's research suggesting the seasonal eating pattern was actually healthier in some ways than our current constant availability model. But I want to talk about the kitchen itself, because the physical space of cooking was completely different. The hearth was the center, but there was also the issue of food storage within the house. Perishables went in the coolest spot, often a north-facing pantry or a larder built into an exterior wall. Meat might hang from the ceiling. Dairy sat in the cool corner or in a spring house if you had one, a small building built over a spring or stream. The running water keeps the interior cool. You'd set crocks of milk and butter directly in the water. It's essentially a water-cooled refrigerator, and it works surprisingly well. Spring houses were common in rural America well into the 19th century.
You've got multiple microclimates in and around your house, and you're routing different foods to different spots based on their spoilage speed. The kitchen is a one room. It's a distributed system.
And cooking itself was a much more continuous activity. You couldn't prep a week of meals on Sunday. You cooked every day, often multiple times a day, because most cooked food wouldn't keep. The hearth fire was maintained continuously in many households. You banked the coals at night so you could revive it in the morning. Starting a fire from scratch was a pain, so you kept it going.
Which means the kitchen was never truly cold. In summer, that must have been miserable.
It was, and this is why summer kitchens were a thing in wealthier households, a separate building or outdoor cooking area so you didn't heat up the main house. But for most people, you just dealt with it. You cooked early in the morning before the day got hot. You ate cold foods when you could.
Let's talk about urban food before refrigeration, because that's a whole different challenge. A rural household has a garden, maybe a cow, a root cellar. What does a Londoner in 1800 do?
This is where the food system gets really elaborate. Cities had enormous supply chains bringing food in daily. Live animals were driven through the streets to urban butchers. Milk was delivered by milkmaids who milked cows kept in city dairies. Yes, there were cows in cities. Vegetables came in from market gardens on the urban fringe. Fish came from the docks every morning. Bread was baked by professional bakers because most urban households didn't have ovens.
The city dweller was more dependent on daily markets, but also had access to more variety because of the concentrated trade.
Urban food was more likely to be adulterated or spoiled. Food fraud was rampant. Bread was cut with chalk and alum. Milk was watered down and colored. Meat from diseased animals was sold. This is actually one of the things that drove early food regulation, the impossibility of knowing what you were buying in an urban market.
The pre-refrigeration city was a food safety nightmare that we've romanticized into farmers' market aesthetics.
There's a class dimension here that's important. The wealthy had ice houses. They had servants managing preservation. They ate fresh meat year-round because they could afford to keep animals and slaughter them on demand. The poor ate preserved foods. Salt fish, salt pork, dried legumes, bread, for most of the year. Fresh meat was a rarity. The class gradient in food was much steeper than it is today.
Refrigeration democratized fresh food in a way that's hard to overstate. The working class in 1920 ate more fresh meat and vegetables than the aristocracy in 1750.
And the transition happened remarkably fast. The first practical mechanical refrigerators for home use appeared around 1913. By 1940, about half of American households had one. By 1960, it was over 90%. In the span of a single lifetime, the entire food system transformed.
What was the first home refrigerator actually like?
The Kelvinator and the Frigidaire were the early brands. They were expensive, around $700 in 1920, which is about $10,000 today. They were essentially industrial machinery crammed into a kitchen cabinet. Toxic refrigerants like sulfur dioxide and methyl formate, compressors that sounded like a small engine running. And they were tiny by modern standards, maybe 4 or 5 cubic feet.
Early adopters were paying 10 grand for a noisy, toxic box the size of a mini fridge.
They were thrilled to do it because the alternative was managing an ice box that needed ice deliveries twice a week, or doing all your preservation by hand. The ice box itself, let me explain this, because it's the transitional technology. An ice box was literally an insulated cabinet with a compartment for a block of ice at the top. Cold air falls, so it circulates down through the food compartment. The ice melted over a couple of days and you had to drain the meltwater and get a new block delivered.
The Iceman cometh. That was a real job, not just a play title.
A huge industry. Ice delivery was a daily sight in American cities well into the 1940s. In 1907, New York City had over 1,000 ice delivery companies.
All of that vanished in what, 20 years?
The ice harvesting industry peaked around 1900 and was effectively dead by 1950. An entire economy, the tools, the skills, the trade routes, the storage facilities, just disappeared.
The speed of that transition is wild. Thousands of years of food preservation knowledge rendered obsolete in 2 generations. My grandmother probably knew how to can vegetables. I don't know a single person my age who does.
Canning is actually a fascinating case because it's a preservation technology invented right at the tail end of the pre-refrigeration era and then absorbed into the post-refrigeration world as a hobby. Nicholas Appert developed the canning process in 1809 in response to a prize offered by Napoleon, who needed a way to feed his armies. Appert used glass jars sealed with wax. The tin can came a few years later from an Englishman named Peter Durand.
Napoleon's armies is the origin of home canning. That's a connection I did not have.
The early cans were terrible. They were made of thick wrought iron, soldered with lead, and you needed a hammer and chisel to open them. The can opener wasn't invented until the 1850s, decades after the can itself. Soldiers opened cans with bayonets.
The can predates the can opener. That's the most Industrial Revolution fact I've ever heard.
It really is. The technology to seal food in metal existed decades before anyone figured out a convenient way to get it back out. That tells you something about how desperate the need for preservation was.
Let's bring this back to daily cooking. You're a household in 1850. You've got a hearth or maybe an early cast iron stove. You've got preserved foods, salt pork, dried beans, root vegetables, flour, maybe some canned goods. What does a typical day's cooking actually look like?
The day starts with reviving the fire. You bank the coals overnight, so you rake them out, add kindling, get a flame going. Breakfast is often a continuation of last night's dinner, maybe porridge made from leftover grains, or bread and butter with preserves. The main meal is midday, and that's where the real cooking happens. You're putting something in a pot that will simmer for hours. A stew with salt pork, dried beans, root vegetables, maybe some cabbage. Bread baked earlier in the week. The evening meal is lighter, leftovers from midday or bread and cheese, maybe soup.
The one-pot meal isn't a convenience thing. It's because you've got one fire and a limited number of pots.
Because long, slow cooking makes preserved ingredients edible. Salt pork needs to be boiled to extract the salt. Dried beans need hours to soften. A pot that simmers all day solves multiple problems at once. It cooks the food, it keeps the kitchen warm, and it means you're not starting from scratch for every meal.
The perpetual stew pot. Was that a real thing or a medieval reenactment myth?
It was real in some contexts, particularly in inns and large households. You'd keep a pot going for days or weeks, adding new ingredients as you went, and the constant simmering kept it safe. But for most households, it was more practical to cook a fresh pot every day or two. The perpetual stew requires a fire that never goes out, and that's a lot of fuel.
Fuel is the other hidden cost here. You're not just managing food, you're managing your wood supply, your fire, your heat. Cooking is energy management.
This shapes architecture. The hearth is positioned to heat the house. In colder climates, the kitchen is the warmest room and everyone gathers there. In the American colonial period, the kitchen was often the only heated room in the house. Bedrooms were unheated. You went to bed in a cold room and hoped your blankets were enough.
Sleeping in an unheated room in a New England winter, that's a level of daily discomfort we've completely forgotten.
It's connected to the food system. The fire that cooked your dinner was also your heating system. When the cooking was done, the fire died down and the house got cold. There was no separating the two functions. The refrigerator, the stove, and the furnace are three separate appliances today, but they used to be one hearth. Untangling them took a century of technological development.
The hearth as the original combined appliance. Heating, cooking, and I guess you could hang meat in the chimney to smoke it, so food preservation too.
The chimney was a smoker. You'd hang hams and bacon up in the chimney where the smoke would cure them. The same structure that vented your fire also preserved your meat. Everything was multi-purpose.
Let's talk about beverages for a moment, because we've been focused on solid food. What did people drink before refrigeration?
Three main categories. One, fermented drinks. Beer, ale, wine, cider. These were safe because the alcohol and acidity killed pathogens. Everyone drank them, including children, though the everyday stuff was often low alcohol, what they called small beer, around 1 or 2%. Two, hot drinks, coffee, tea, herbal infusions. Boiling makes water safe. Three, water from known clean sources, springs, wells. But people were wary of water in cities, often for good reason.
The stereotype of medieval people drinking beer instead of water. That's actually true?
It's oversimplified but directionally correct. In many places and times, water was considered a poor person's drink because the wealthy could afford wine or beer. But clean water was available in many places and people drank it when they trusted the source. What's true is that fermented beverages were a major source of calories and safe hydration. A farm worker might drink several liters of small beer a day.
This connects to the cooking, because beer and wine are ingredients too. You're cooking with ale, making wine sauces, using cider to braise meat.
Vinegar, don't forget vinegar. Every household had a vinegar barrel. Wine that went sour didn't get thrown out. It became vinegar, which is itself a preservative. Pickling in vinegar was a major preservation method, especially for vegetables and eggs. The vinegar barrel was essentially the household's acid supply for cooking, for cleaning, for medicine.
The pre-refrigeration kitchen is a chemistry lab. You're managing fermentation, acidification, dehydration, salt curing, smoking. It's applied microbiology before anyone knew what a microbe was.
They got remarkably good at it through pure empiricism. Generations of trial and error produced techniques that we now understand scientifically, but that worked perfectly well without that understanding. Sauerkraut fermentation selects for lactic acid bacteria naturally present on cabbage leaves. You don't need to know about lactobacillus. You just need to know that shredded cabbage packed in salt and left in a crock will turn into something edible and preservable.
The knowledge was embedded in the practice. You didn't need theory if your grandmother showed you how to do it, and it worked every time.
This is what I find poignant about the whole thing. When refrigeration arrived, a lot of this knowledge just evaporated, not immediately. The transition took a couple of generations. But by the 1960s, most American households had no idea how to preserve food without a freezer. Canning hung on as a rural tradition and then as a hipster revival. But the deep knowledge, how to salt a ham, how to manage a root cellar, how to judge the safety of fermented foods, that's mostly gone.
We traded a set of skills for a box that hums in the corner. And I'm not saying that's a bad trade. Refrigeration is one of the greatest public health interventions in human history. But something was lost.
Food spoilage was a major cause of illness and death before refrigeration. Botulism from improperly canned foods. Ergotism from moldy grain. Food poisoning from meat that was slightly off. The refrigerator eliminated a huge amount of that risk, and that's genuinely wonderful. But it also made us passive consumers of food rather than active preservers of it.
The passivity point is interesting. When you have to actively preserve your food, you're in a constant relationship with it. You're checking the sauerkraut crock. You're turning the hams in the chimney. You're sniffing the milk to see if it's turned. Food demands your attention.
That attention created a different relationship with waste. You couldn't afford to waste anything because every calorie represented labor. Vegetable scraps went into stock. Stale bread became bread pudding. Sour milk became a baking ingredient. Meat bones got boiled for hours. The pre-refrigeration kitchen was essentially a zero-waste system, not because of environmental ideology, but because waste meant hunger.
The original circular economy. Nothing left the system except what humans consumed.
Let me give you one more specific example that crystallizes this. In pre-refrigeration households, fat was one of the most valuable substances. You rendered lard from pigs. You saved bacon grease. You clarified butter to make it last longer. Fat was cooking medium, preservative, and concentrated calories all in one. A household that ran out of fat in winter was in real trouble.
Now we buy canola oil in plastic bottles and throw away bacon grease because we've been told it's unhealthy.
The bacon grease jar on the stove. That was universal in American kitchens well into the 20th century. My grandmother had one. She used it for everything. Fried eggs, sautéed vegetables, cornbread. That jar represented a direct line back to the pre-refrigeration world, where no calorie could be wasted.
What killed the bacon grease jar? Was it refrigeration, or was it the health messaging around saturated fat?
Both, plus the rise of cheap vegetable oils. When you could buy a quart of canola oil for a few dollars, saving bacon grease stops being an economic necessity and becomes a flavor choice. The pre-refrigeration technique is being revived as a gourmet thing.
Everything old becomes a Brooklyn restaurant menu item eventually.
They charge you $28 for it.
Let's pull this together. Pre-refrigeration life was defined by a seasonal rhythm of preservation, a continuous relationship with fire, a zero-waste kitchen economy, and a set of skills that most people today have completely lost. The refrigerator made food abundant, safe, and convenient. It also made us forget how much work food used to be.
I think that's the core insight. The refrigerator didn't just keep food cold, it collapsed time. Seasonal foods became available year-round. Perishable foods became storable. Daily cooking became weekly meal prep. The entire temporal structure of eating changed.
That's exactly it. The refrigerator is a time machine. It slows down spoilage so dramatically that it breaks the seasonal cycle that governed human eating for millennia.
We're still figuring out the consequences of that. The nutritional consequences, the cultural consequences, the environmental consequences. The average American household throws away about 30% of its food, which would have been an unthinkable horror to someone in 1800. We've become so insulated from the work of food preservation that we've lost the instinct to use things up.
The refrigerator giveth, and the refrigerator taketh away. Abundance breeds waste.
There's actually a counter-movement now. People getting into fermentation, into canning, into root cellaring. Not out of necessity, but out of a desire to reconnect with that knowledge. The pandemic saw a huge surge in home food preservation. Sourdough starters everywhere.
The sourdough renaissance of 2020. A moment when half the developed world suddenly remembered that bread comes from somewhere.
That instinct, I think, is genuine. There's something satisfying about preserving your own food that buying a plastic-wrapped version from a refrigerated shelf doesn't replicate. It's the satisfaction of competence, of self-reliance, of participating in a chain of knowledge that goes back thousands of years.
The question of how people managed without refrigeration. The answer is that they managed through constant work, deep knowledge, and an entirely different relationship with time and seasons. The refrigerator didn't just change how we store food. It changed how we think about food.
It changed how we cook. The modern recipe assumes refrigeration. It assumes you have fresh meat, fresh dairy, fresh produce available whenever you want. Pre-refrigeration cooking started from a completely different set of assumptions. You're not asking, what do I want to eat? You're asking what needs to be used, what's in season, what's been preserved, what's about to turn. The ingredients dictate the meal, not the other way around.
That's actually a useful perspective even today. Cooking from what you have rather than what you want. It's more creative, in a way.
It is, and it's more economical, and it's more connected to the actual conditions of food production. Even with refrigeration, there's a lot to be said for cooking like a pre-industrial peasant, not in the sense of deprivation, but in the sense of attention. Paying attention to what's in your kitchen, what needs to be used, what the seasons are offering.
The pre-refrigeration mindset applied to a post-refrigeration kitchen. That might be the sweet spot.
I think it is. Use the fridge, but don't let the fridge do all your thinking for you. Know how to preserve. know how to use things up, know where your food comes from, and when.
Maybe keep a bacon grease jar on the stove.
And for cornbread.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, the indigenous Maori of New Zealand's South Island developed a variation of the abacus that used notched pebbles instead of beads, inadvertently creating a system where a single misplaced pebble could turn a tally of preserved eels into a declaration of war.
Right, right. That seems like a design flaw.
A fairly significant one, yeah. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps. Until next time.
Don't declare war on any eels.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.